You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last year, Sunday Night Football beat out both American Idol and the Academy Awards as the country's most popular TV broadcast. But whether you're a season ticket holder or someone who watches the game from your couch, you probably only have an inkling of most of the things that go on off the field. Nicholas Davidoff, however, knew enough about football to accept Jets head coach Rex Ryan's invitation to spend the 2011 season with the team. In his new book, Collision Low Crossers, A Year Inside the Turbulent World of NFL Football, Mr. Davidoff reveals a side of football few see, including practices, strategy meetings, and intimate profiles of the Jets' most talked-about players. It's published by Little Brown. I'm very pleased it has brought Nicholas Davidoff back to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Now, previous books were largely about baseball. Had you always wanted to write about football?
No, I guess I was, when I began to think about this book, I thought about it in terms of what I saw or really what I didn't see on a television screen. It just seemed like an amazing thing to me that the most popular thing in America was entirely based on plans and ideas and close to 350 days of preparation that nobody sees.
Quite different than baseball, where there is some planning, but there aren't all these secret strategy meetings, are there?
Right. The secret things in baseball are signs, and most of the signs you pretty much figure out what happened, whereas in football, these coaches standing on the sidelines, you watch them, and it looks like they're holding a bistro menu in front of their face, you know, because they're afraid of opposition lip-reading. And I always just wondered, what was on that menu, and how did it come to be?
Now, the Huffington Post reports that President Obama bought your book just this past Saturday. Considering the way the Jets have been playing the last few years, it can't be because he's looking for a winning formula.
I know. When this happened, I thought of the Paul Simon line, you know, when he's singing, "I got the presidential seal." I just hope it gives him some pleasure. But I also was mindful that it's a trying time for him and that politics and football are alike in the sense that, you know, you're up, you're down. And I guess I thought that football to me really is more about failure than anything else. There are 32 teams in the NFL. Only one can win. And one of the most signal aspects, I think, of my experience with one of those teams was that when a team wins, they just go on to the next. They don't even really think about it. And when they lose, it's devastating. Nobody can sleep. You walk into the facility on a Monday morning, and it's the picture of depression. It's like a storm has happened, and they're overturned garbage cans and, I don't know, broken glass. And just every image you have of just something that has been wrecked. These people have put everything they have into something, and they've spent all their time to the exclusion of everything else. They don't see their children. They don't see their families. And they come in on Monday morning, and they've had this enormous public failure. And to me, professional football is really what you do with failure and how you overcome it.
Well, the 2011 season for the Jets was not a great one, but nothing like the last two. And I was wondering if you wish you had waited to be invited to witness last season or this season, because there would be so many more juicy stories.
For me, it wasn't, I guess I felt very privileged to be there at that time only because everybody told me that what I saw was a representative season, an emblematic season. You know, they finished 8-8, but I wasn't really in it for any. The general manager, Mike Tannenbaum, told me at the beginning of the year, he said, anything can happen, you know, and then he mentioned some players and he said, if this person gets hurt, you know, we could go 3-13 or something. And to me, those were never my concerns because I was much more interested in what the public doesn't see. I was interested in a group of people, which were the coaches, working together in this, you know, rarefied, closed-off place on something to the exclusion of everything else. I mean, they're working. I mean, it's like a bunch of surgeons or if you wanted to write a book about the Manhattan Project or something like that. I just like the idea of a group of people who are committed in a stupefyingly committed to something and working together all the time. So for me, it was always going to be an office story.
Well, you write that you wouldn't call yourself an expert in football. So how did Rex Ryan come to approach you about spending a year with the Jets?
I wouldn't quite – I mean, he eventually invited me, but I guess it began – I heard him on the radio. I was thinking about what my next book would be, and I write pieces for the magazines that I write for about various subjects as I see whether they'll sustain me across the life of a book. And I had various political ideas, and then I heard Rex Ryan talking on the radio, and I just thought instantly that this was a special person, or as he would say, a special dude, you know, or a unique dude. He has this way of speaking and this way of behaving that I think is entirely singular to him. And I realized that he gets a lot of press out in the world, but within that more closed facility atmosphere, he is a beloved, extremely charismatic person. And, you know, so I wrote this piece about him anyway for the New York Times Magazine, and the piece was a profile of Rex, but what really drew me to football then were all the people who were working for him.
Well, you say that he is unique in the way he talks, different from his brother, Rob Ryan, the defensive coordinator for the New Orleans Saints, or their father, the legendary coach, Buddy Ryan?
I think Buddy Ryan was a defensive genius. Everybody says that.
And they call Rex a defensive genius, and his brother is a defensive coordinator for the Saints.
Right. They all really, really understand defensive football. I think what separates Rex from the other two, and Rob is much more this way than he is Buddy's way, but I would think what separates Rex is that he is a really humane person. I came to think of him as someone who had almost what I thought of as a football metabolism. You have to understand that in an NFL facility, somebody like Rex Ryan is responsible for close to 100 people. And his interactions with those people seem to me very much to replicate almost the pace and the pattern of football, which is a Twitter pace. You know, it stops and it starts. And Rex has these 82-second interactions all day long. And he's a master in these moments at getting people to reveal something of themselves that then relates in some sort of strange way that only Rex can really extract to football. And so whereas most defensive teams are, you know, every person, there's a scheme and every person in on the team who's starting has a role within the scheme. For Rex, the scheme is much looser. It's more flexible. It's elastic. And Rex, as he comes to learn about the people who play for him, even the worst players on his roster, he'll find what's special about them and he'll integrate them into the scheme in a unique way. And that's what makes him a great coach.
And you say that he is so deeply lovable that people would forgive him for almost anything. Now, he invited you to do this right after there was a little scandal on YouTube involving foot fetishes. He said it was a personal matter. Do you think that he wanted to clear up his image? Is that one of the reasons he invited you to follow him around?
I don't think so. I think if it had been up to Rex, I think that was more probably a public relations decision that was not in his hands. Rex would have loved to talk about it. I mean, around the facility, everybody teases him about it, and he's human, and he's got very much his own distinct personality. And I think he would always say when people would tease him about it, he'd say, "Yeah, I'm the only guy in the world who gets into a sex scandal with his wife." I mean, he's been married for more than 25 years. You know, I mean, he's just.
Did he give you any guidelines?
No.
Were there any subjects that were off limits?
You know, my only guideline, I could go anywhere and do anything. You have to make a choice. In football, the offense and the defense are really like separate states within the same country and states that are pretty rivalrous and don't have much to do with one another. And since everybody knows a little bit about touchdowns, I thought I would be more interested in writing about defense, especially because the Jets have this very original and creative defense. So I spent all of my time with the Jets defensive coaches, except I began, just for balance, I began the day in the quarterbacks meeting with the four quarterbacks and the two coaches.
My guest is Nicholas Davidoff, Dawidoff. His latest book, Collision Low Crossers, A Year Inside the Turbulent World of NFL Football. What does Collision Low Crossers mean?
Well, see, that's one of the things I like about football is that it has – in my first book, I wrote about intelligence officers, and football seemed to me a little the same way, that these are people who are engaged in this very public endeavor, but they're doing it in private, and they even have their own secret language. And Collision Low Crossers is a defensive term. It means essentially that a defensive player can hit and knock off his pass route any receiver within 5 yards in the line of scrimmage. After 5 yards, it's a penalty. But I think what I especially liked about the term is that expresses the essential calamity of what goes on out there in a football game. You know, there's always somebody out there who's waiting to ruin your life. And I like that football has its own language. I like also that football is full of risk and try so hard to be predictable that these people are giving over their lives to control something that is inherently uncontrollable.
And you write that you look forward to watching the people who, quote, attempt to impose order on a significantly unstable pursuit. How much does Rex Ryan think he can control things in a game when you have 22 players out on the field and all sorts of possibilities that nobody could predict?
Well, one of the things that the coaches told me is that there's when you call a given play, only 10 90% of the time do all 11 people do what they're supposed to do as it's been diagrammed. Yet, and so it seems almost delusional that you can expect to control the pursuit. On the other hand, you can always try for 11%.
Well, you say that Rex Ryan is someone who seemed to think he could overcome the randomness with conviction, as though his wanting something badly enough meant that he could will it into being. Well, why hasn't it worked out that way? How does he explain the fact that the Jets have had some pretty bad seasons recently?
I don't think that Rex would publicly want to explain why, but if you just forced him to tell you the truth, the way that the NFL rules now, especially given national and NFL now concern following the national concern about concussion, means that the offense has a distinct advantage, and the position that has the greatest advantage is quarterback. So if you have a really good quarterback, you're in a very good position in the NFL if you can keep him healthy, like a Tom Brady or a Drew Brees or a Peyton Manning. But if you have a young quarterback who is inconsistent, like a Mark Sanchez or a Geno Smith, your life is going to be much more difficult.
Well, the Jets put a lot of money into Mark Sanchez and also Darrell Revis the year that you were covering them. It cost a quarter of the Jets' salary cap in forced budget. But why did that hurt them? A lot of teams have star players who get big money.
Well, Darrell Revis is possibly the best defensive player of his time. But since the rules of the sport right now are so much canted toward offense, you better have star players who are offensive players. And the fact is that Mark Sanchez, while they hoped he would be a star, he really is in certain ways the representative NFL player, which is to say so much money goes into research and development. So much, I mean, the algorithms, the portfolios, the dossiers that these scouts are, you know, compiling on various players, and then they draft them and they nurture them. And even in Mark Sanchez's fourth year, they still had no idea how good he was. You just can't tell.
They kept on predicting every year, well, this is the year he's going to have figured it out. He's been talking to the coaches, and he knows all sorts of things that he didn't know before. And then he'd go out there and throw more interceptions than is acceptable.
More interceptions in crucial moments. It was, and, you know, interceptions and turnovers, those are the things that just completely demoralize a team. I don't know. Sanchez has everything going for him that you'd want in a quarterback. He's smart. He's athletically gifted. He's hardworking. I mean, during his breaks during practice, he'd be running wind sprints. You know, if he wasn't getting along with a player, he'd make it a point then to, during practice, to go off and spend special time with him. I mean, it's just one of those things about football, and I think it's one of the reasons we like it. It's so unpredictable.
And then last season, they traded for Tim Tebow when almost every football expert thought it was a big mistake. That was after you covered the team. But I wondered whether this had as much to do with Woody Johnson, the Jets owner, liking Tim Tebow's politics. Didn't Johnson say that he felt it was more important for Mitt Romney to win the presidency than for the Jets to win the Super Bowl, which may have been his feeling, but it seems to me rather indiscreet considering the fact that the Jets probably have a fair number of Democrats who root for them.
You know, I think that what Tebow really boiled down to is that with every big football decision, and I watched a lot of them happen, with every big football decision, they are understandable why the decision is made. And looking back, you can see why it failed, because all the information for failure was there too. But it's just, I think that's why I like to think about sort of football and politics in the same way. The war room and either the draft room or the game planning room, these are similar, highly charged little spaces where people are working very hard and thinking very hard about decisions with huge public implications, and sometimes those decisions go very, very wrong. I think there's still people with the Jets who don't quite understand why Tebow went so awry, because the year before Tebow, they had a quarterback who was known as the change of pace quarterback for Sanchez, a running quarterback who they'd bring on occasion named Brad Smith. Who they let go. You know, he was an expensive free agent. And they brought Tebow in, and they thought he'd fulfill that role, and he wasn't the analog.
And he hasn't been the analog for anybody. In fact, now he's out of football.
It's just amazing that somebody who Rex Ryan considered, at least in 2011, possibly the greatest college player there ever was, could be such a bust in the NFL.
My guest is Nicholas Davidoff. His latest book, Collision Low Crossers, A Year Inside the Turbulent World of NFL Football, published by Little Brown. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Nicholas Davidoff, who is the author of four previous critically acclaimed books, including the best-selling The Catcher Was a Spy and The Crowd Sounds Happy. His latest is Collision Low Crossers, A Year Inside the Turbulent World of NFL Football. It's published by Little Brown. Does the football season never end for the coaches?
Never ends. The day if a team doesn't do well, doesn't make the playoffs, then in that period between, as other teams are competing in the playoffs, the coaches come in and they're already starting to work on the following year's draft. They're preparing for what's called the NFL Combine, which is the annual sort of talent show of college players that goes on in Indianapolis. And they're also waiting to see if they're fired.
And sometimes they are.
Right.
Many of the Jets coaches who were there when you wrote this book are no longer with the team.
But some of them in optimistic ways. I mean, Rex Ryan really had two ambitions. One of them everybody knows about because he guaranteed a Super Bowl during his tenure, which so far hasn't happened. But the other was that his coaching staff, that people would be elevated either to become offensive or defensive coordinators of other teams or head coaches. And so many of the people who were on the staff when I was there are now spread out all across the country running the Kansas City Chiefs defense and all the way through. And so for me, when I look now at the map of the United States, I see these little flares in Chicago and Dallas and Kansas City and St. Louis, and they're all football coaches.
On the other hand, when they're let go, we're told that the new person who's coming in is going to correct all the problems. That's what happened with the offensive coordinator this year because everybody was so disillusioned with last year's. And, of course, isn't it really just the talent on the team? How much of it is the coaches?
I think that the Jets coaches, the defensive coordinator Mike Patton, who is the defensive coordinator of the Jets previously and now he's the defensive coordinator for the Buffalo Bills, I think that he would say that nothing can overcome talent. That no coach should be so arrogant as to think that, you know, that any kind of game plan could overcome really good talent. But there's also a fair amount of luck in football, too.
And there's also the matter of injuries. And recently we've been hearing an awful lot about the effect of head injuries, which the NFL denied was a problem. Concussions were a problem for a long time. And they enlisted, in fact, the Jets doctor way before you got involved in this, to prove that it wasn't that concussions were not a serious problem. He wasn't a neurologist.
That whole episode in the NFL is shameful. I never understand why, when something is in your best interest, health is in the NFL's best interests, why they wouldn't have taken a more active role in thinking hard about something which is the greatest threat to the game.
So did they think about it now? Was that something that they discussed?
You wouldn't find it discussed in an NFL facility, and I think that's because most football players are very young, and a lot of them, of course, think they're going to live forever. But also, I think it is so difficult to be in the NFL and then to stay in the NFL. There's the expression for somebody who's been cut from a team is that he's on the street. And I think it really beautifully expresses the divide between the facility wall and being within. And I think that also it's true that you can't play on an NFL team if everybody gets hurt, but nobody thinks they're going to get hurt. If you're going out there thinking you're going to get hurt, you won't be an effective football player.
Well, I've always wondered about the running backs and the wide receivers because they are being hit constantly, and they usually have shorter careers.
I think, especially running backs. Oh. Yeah, I think that there's one of the things that people talk about is called a gladiator complex, that people just don't believe it's going to be them.
Now, you mentioned the combines, that they're kind of auditions for all of the various scouts, kind of a screen test, you say, a beauty pageant, and a strongman contest at a football county fair. How much do they really determine what players wind up being drafted in what order?
It's like anything else in these sorts of businesses. There's just a certain kind of momentum, and it's a strange momentum that can develop, and the combine is one of the places where momentum can begin. I also think of the combine as just a wonderful thing to see because it's the NFL convention, except for the Super Bowl. So it was, for me, just a lot of fun to watch all these people sort of mixing it up and Rex Ryan right at this vortex.
Well, they often get it wrong. For example, the most effective quarterback in football these days was not drafted number one or even, I think, in the top 10 of his season.
He was drafted in the low sixth round, and that was just – when you're drafted in the sixth round, you could just as easily be a free agent. It's Tom Brady, I think we're talking about. Yeah.
So how much do they actually know? I'm assuming that most of the decisions are based on their college careers, but that is really uneven. Unless they play for one of the best teams in the country, you have no idea whether their statistics are because they were playing against inferior defenses or whether they were really great.
Well, I wrote a book about my grandfather, who was a Harvard economist who was known as the Harvard professor who knew the most. And what all of the very smart people who were his friends used to tell me as I was thinking about that book was, the thing that people who know the most know best is how little they know. And football people, I guarantee it, know the most about how the people they're thinking about drafting, and it's still such an enigma.
Although there are certain scouts, head scouts, and general managers who draft very well year after year after year. So what were the Jets looking for in the 2011 combine?
Well, the Jets drafted extremely well in 2011. They drafted Muhammad Wilkerson in the first round. They got him at
He's
number 30.
He's going to be a Pro Bowler this
year. He's going to be a Pro Bowl defensive lineman. They drafted Bilal Powell, who's a starting running back. They drafted Greg McElroy in the seventh round, and he played for them and made the team.
No longer,
but he's he was still, for that low a draft choice, he was still something. Kenrick Ellis has done pretty well. He's still a viable defensive lineman. It's tough. I mean, if you run down some of the best talent evaluators in the business, like Bill Belichick, they miss all the time. It is just a business that is fraught with uncertainty. And again, I think that's really why people like it so much. That because of all that uncertainty, it's just like politics. It allows a certain amount of speculation from those of us who are just sitting out there, and it's fun for us.
Now, there was a lockout the year that you covered the Jets. How did that affect the draft and preparation?
It didn't affect the preparation at all. The only thing it affected was that the players weren't there for a period of time in the offseason.
Were they expected to come in really good shape?
Nobody knew. The day that the players came back, everybody was looking them over to see, that guy been drinking too much beer. Is he looking a little portly or something like that? I mean, but for me, it was actually pretty serendipitous because it meant I got to spend all the more time with my main characters, who is this group of coaches, and I got to know them better, and I could have conversations with them about things that weren't related to football since we would talk about Simon and Garfunkel.
Do they get along,
the coaches?
It's absolutely, because they all have their little fiefdoms.
I think that it really is, more than most places I've ever been, a pretty collective endeavor. It is military in the sense that it's top down or it has that kind of stratification, but you have to get along. Now, when a team starts losing, every team in the NFL, when they start losing, that's the difficult time. I remember the Jets began my year and they were 2-0. We were out on the practice field and it was giddy with excitement and good feeling. And the Jets quarterback coach that year was Matt Kavanaugh, who was a former longtime NFL player, and he came over to me and he looked at me and he said, "This isn't the NFL that you're seeing. It's only when you're losing that you really see the NFL, because it's just like, it's just loss determines how well you will win."
And you got to see the NFL, the real NFL, very soon afterward.
I did. I saw a regressing quarterback for the offense, and I saw a defense that lost its two smartest, most essential players, aside from Revis, a safety, Jim Leonard, who's known as the quarterback of the defense. He was hurt when they were on a winning streak, and they lost the last three games after he was hurt. And Brian Thomas, the outside linebacker, who set the edge and did all of this, the really sort of esoteric little football responsibilities were his that make a team win or not.
They allowed Jim Leonard to leave as well after an injury. He's done fairly well. Couldn't they have tried to retain him if he was so smart? He sounds to me like somebody's going to wind up being a coach in the future.
Probably will be. I mean, he gave me a document once that was 120 pages long, and it was basically a smart NFL safety's notes to self. It was his sort of treatise on the Rex Ryan defense, and it was fascinating to read. The reason that I think, he's pretty slow by NFL standards, and that was his second leg injury. So I think that's why they let him go. But I'll tell you, Mike Pettine, his old defensive coordinator with the Jets, now in Buffalo, telling me all the time that Jimmy Leonard is saving his season as it is.
My guess is Nicholas Davidoff, Davidoff. His latest book, Collision Low Crossers, A Year Inside the Turbulent World of NFL Football. It is published by Little Brown. You found that NFL coaches watch more football on film than they do live on the field. What are they looking for when they're looking at the film? Are they looking for what worked or what went wrong?
It took me a while to figure it out because obviously there's no sound, and I didn't speak the language. I didn't know what things like collision low crossers meant. So for, you know, coaches have two views. They have the end zone view, and then they've got a view from the 50-yard line that's above. And what they're doing is they are evaluating every single player's performance on every single play. And this may require looking at him two or three times, moving the film back and forth. And then they grade them. And sometimes the grades come with comments, and the comments are fierce. They're often little screeds, especially if something goes badly, because really what they're doing is, again, with the margin so tight between success and failure, what they're really doing is they're just trying to move people a little better, and they think that the way to do it is with that old goad, which is criticism. And that's why Rex Ryan's real mantra is, you have to have skin like an armadillo. It's a blunt force trauma world. And yet, that's one of the things that makes Rex so appealing to players is, even though he says this, the most sensitive players on the team are the ones he's most protective of.
I wonder what happens when the coaches watch film and see a penalty not called or a penalty called that they feel shouldn't have been called.
Even when they're watching film from 4 years previous and it's a penalty that was called that shouldn't have been called, their heads are going to explode. They just can't believe it. I mean, you know, it was so clear to me always that they just weren't over it.
You write that Mike Pettine, the defensive coordinator, frequently made up his own expressions to the point where you became an amateur Pettine scholar. What kinds of expressions did he make up? Did the other coaches know what he was talking about?
Oh, they did, because these expressions, you know, would be used by Pettine as they were watching film, and it's like anything else. You know, if you go to Bangkok, if you hear someone speaking Thai long enough, you'll speak Thai too. So soon all the other coaches were speaking Pettine's version of Thai. And so, yeah, there's a whole glossary of Pettine terms in the book.
One of the coaches, Mike Smith, who is known as Smitty, started as an intern, went on to work as an outside linebacker coach before he left to work in college football in the middle of the season. Is that unusual to leave in the middle of the season?
He didn't leave in the middle of the season. He was offered a job in the middle of the season, which isn't unusual because once teams finish, like if a college team finishes, it may hire a new coach, and then he immediately wants to fill his staff. So in the middle of the Jets season, Smitty was getting coaching offers, and he was trying to decide what to do because it was his college coach who was offering him a job. And Mike Smith is a very, very loyal and endearing person. He was someone who played as a Baltimore Raven for Rex Ryan and Mike Pettine, and then he had a career-ending injury. And they knew that Smitty would become a really, really good coach because players who don't become good coaches are players who are still living in their playing past. Once Smitty's career was, you know, so abruptly truncated, he immediately was all about other people. And that's really what a coach amounts to. It's someone who is curious and engaged in the lives of other people, who's compassionate and empathetic. I know these are football coaches and these are surprising words to use, but it's really true. If your whole life can be devoted to improving someone else's life, that's really a coach.
So he gave up the idea of becoming a college coach. Is he still with the Jets?
After the season ended, he spent another year with the Jets last year. And this year, he and his wife were about to have their first child, and he was offered the defensive coordinator job at Texas Tech. So he's now living – and he grew up in Lubbock, so he was back out in Lubbock.
Locker room politics have been in the news recently. You've even written about the Miami Dolphins bullying controversy for the New Yorker's website. Did you witness bullying in the locker room, in the Jets locker room?
No, but I witnessed nothing like what is supposed to have happened in Miami, and certainly nobody who I've talked to subsequently with the Jets ever saw anything like it.
But the Miami players said, oh, this is life in the NFL. This is what every locker room is like.
That's not what every locker room is like. But what every locker room is like is this. I mean, I think my experiences are a pretty good example. I mean, I was different. The NFL is taking you can think of the huddle as America, a little bit of everyone, and then you have to collect all of these disparate people into a sense of unified purpose. And the way you do it, in part, is with teasing. It's just like high school or just like any other office, per se. But every one of us since high school can tell the difference between teasing that is affectionate and inclusive and something that is meant to express an unpleasant power dynamic that is meant to hurt. And there were a couple occasions when I saw people saying things that were meant to hurt other people, but nothing on the scale of what went on in Miami.
Well, there are a lot of pranks you describe, including the super gluing the lid on the communal peanut butter jar, which Rex Ryan had been eating out of, and they filmed him trying to open it. This sounds like high school stuff.
There wasn't that much of that stuff, but when it happened, I mean, it was funny. I mean, I have to say that a lot of the pranks that were played around the facility, things like that just make people like coming to work a little more. You, I mean, their life is – they are working so hard. Some of them were trying – the offensive coordinator, Brian Schottenheimer, by the end of the season had all but eliminated sleep. If he was sleeping 3 hours a night, I wouldn't believe it. They are working so hard. So something which – if you are devoting all of your life to the exclusion of everything else, to be in this place that has no windows, where your whole life is football – anything that makes it a little bit more fun is better. And that's Rex's coaching philosophy too. Practicing and coaching football involves a tremendous amount of repetition, and it is tedious. In any way that you can make the repetition not seem repetitious, which this is one of Rex's real areas of expertise, that's a valuable thing in a football coach.
Well, you mentioned earlier that there's always this feeling, well, next week we will do better after a loss. But I imagine there comes a time during a losing season of the sort that the Jets went through last year, perhaps will be going through from now on, where people understand that they're not going to win many games, if any. So what happens then? Did people just give up, or they start playing for the next contract?
I don't doubt your premise, but, you know, I never saw that. I think that the way the NFL people that I knew think of it is they think of it in terms of their resume. Everything that they put on film is going to be watched by the other 31 teams around the league. So no matter how awry your season's going, you still have the opportunity to display what you're about to another team. And often the way that NFL talent evaluators work is they will look at a bad team's film from the end of the season, and they'll see who's still displaying effort and skill in exactly the circumstances you describe.
And the pundits have no idea that the New York Times predicted the Jets would win yesterday. They lost 23-3 to the Dolphins and looked pretty awful in the process.
They did. I think the problem yesterday was similar to the problems throughout 2011, which is the Jets have a really, really good defense. But if your defense spends too much time on the field and it's like you get tired. You have a certain amount of retardant and it eventually gives way to the burn.
So that's what happened, and that's why the Dolphins at the end looked like an offensive juggernaut. I mean, yeah, they were just marching across down the field.
Only at the end, but if you look at the time of possession for the game, I think the Jets' problems this year are fairly similar to the problems in 2011. It's just really hard to win without an extremely competent quarterback.
PBS reports that there have been 101 concussions in the NFL in this season. Did the Jets suffer many concussions the year you were there?
Not too many. I remember during one game, one of the players was thought to have suffered a concussion, and I was surprised. I mean, this is, I guess, you know, the NFL's come a long way in terms of health. Even the younger players would say that when they were in college, if you went into the training room, it was a sign of weakness. And now if you go into the training room, it's considered something professional because you're supposed to take care of your career and you're supposed to serve the team as well as possible. So it's considered shrewd. And I remember that when one of the players was thought to have had a concussion during a game, from the general manager sitting up in the box, Mike Tannenbaum, immediately called his parents. You know, I think he called his girlfriend. You know, I mean, there was a certain, you know, familial concern that always really impressed me. That was one of the things I really hadn't expected about football. I always assumed that the people who played professional football did so, well, because they were athletically suited to it and also because they liked something that was really, really aggressive. But More than a surprising number of the players, I would say, told me that the real appeal of football to them, many, many NFL players grew up under straitened circumstances. They grew up in single-family homes. Some of them were even orphans. A lot of them grew up in real poverty. And what a lot of them would say is that football was an opportunity to have some of the things a little later in life that they lacked as children, that there was a surrogate familial atmosphere.
Coaches and former players often tell you that you don't see the game that they see, and that's not just in football. I've had baseball players tell me the same thing. So now that you've gone through this, do you see something different when you're watching a game on television?
I'm sure I do see something different. I can see a lot more, but I really miss those coaching angles, you know, sitting in that room, looking at it from – I mean, the coaching film is a different kind of film, and looking at it from that privileged angle with those seven narrators sitting around that long table with their energy drinks talking about it all – You see then, I mean, the players on a Monday morning will come into the cafeteria and at breakfast, and they'll ask the coaches how the film looked. Sometimes even the players have no idea how well they played. It's such an intricately choreographed sport. It is so difficult to really measure what happened in any given play. It's just, it's almost impossible to think that any of us who are watching it are really seeing it. And that's one of the things that I thought was most beautiful about football. Here's the most popular entertainment in America, something that gives people tremendous pleasure. We're sitting there watching it every Sunday on the screen, right? And it's a completely different game that's actually happening. It's a fascinating dichotomy.
Nicholas Davidoff's book, Collision Low Crossers, A Year Inside the Turbulent World of NFL Football, has gotten rave reviews from people like Thomas Powers, who called it one of the best books ever written about sports, from Frank DeFord, and many others. And now President Obama has bought a copy. It's called Collision Low Crossers, A Year Inside the Turbulent World of NFL Football. Little Brown is the publisher. I'm wondering whether John Boehner will now buy a copy once he's heard that Obama's bought his. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
It was so nice to be here again. Thank you.